Can you hear me okay? My voice, maybe even with this, doesn't carry very far. I should probably just start by saying I'm one of those who tends not to read the paper that I write. What I see is the good side is that you're less likely to fall asleep. When I read, I tend to go more flat. On the other hand, the bad side is that I may miss something as I go, and so I'll keep it in front of me and look down once in a while, but unless you object, I'd rather not read it. Now, one of the things that I found interesting as I've grown up down the street here practically, and then as I've learned more about psychology, is some of the connections that I've noted between it and Mormonism, and the beliefs that I grew up with as a young Mormon, and then sometimes perhaps had to modify just a bit, or maybe more than just a bit. It's an interesting thing to me. There are a few things that I find more fascinating. So I guess I'll just dive right in. One of the core similarities and differences all at the same time that I found between the two is that they both really rely on experience. Experience seems to play a central role in Mormon experience as well as in psychology. That comes through in Mormonism in the idea that we can gain knowledge. We can understand things about our world, about God, our relationship to both, through the experiences that we have. The Doctrine and Covenant suggests that things should give us experience. That was one of my grandpa's favorite scriptures. The things that we experience are for our good, even though we might not at the time really enjoy them. Other basic Mormon doctrines that I grew up with have to do with the idea that we lived some time before coming to Earth, and that we came to Earth in order to have a body, and that with that body we could have experiences that weren't possible without the body. The body seems to be really important. Neil Maxwell said not too long ago that these experiences include developing, quote, divine attributes of love, mercy, patience, submissiveness, meekness, purity, and others that cannot be developed in the abstract, end quote. So the theme here is that by experiencing something firsthand, we really seem to develop a better understanding of it. And our experiences confirm our view of ourselves and our world and God and our relationship to those. Now, so how it seems to me is Mormonism suggests that experience is a kind of personal evidence. And like a jury or a scientist, we don't want just one little bit of evidence. We want lots of evidence and see how well those different pieces of evidence go together. We try to confirm our experiences. These confirmations might come in many different forms. We can try to repeat the experience ourselves to see if we have the same kind of result. We can look to others around us to see if they seem to be having the same kinds of experiences and thereby validate what we've experienced. And we might seek a sort of spiritual confirmation from God to see if our earlier experiences seem to be sanctioned by God. Now, in each of these, these kinds of experiences, we can illustrate them through missionary work. The person who's investigating the church is encouraged to have their own experiences that confirm what they've heard as being true. The missionaries are encouraged to share when the investigator has some kind of question. The missionaries are encouraged to share their personal experiences, their testimonies, as a sort of evidence. In a couple different ways, that models for the investigator the kinds of experiences that he or she might be expected to have or might anticipate. It tells the other missionary that they have something in common with their companion, and it reminds the person who gives the testimony about what they've had before, what they've experienced before. Now, that's the way Mormonism seems to use experience. In psychology, we seem to use it a bit differently. There are some similarities, but not across the board. Experience in psychology, in my background as a research psychologist, it really seems to focus on experimentation. The idea that by doing an experiment, by having that particular kind of controlled experience, we might be able to understand something better. Now, one way to try to understand the way psychology uses experience is just by examining the assumptions that underlie experiments in the field. One research method text that I use in my classes lists five basic assumptions that the psychological experiment has, or that the psychologist has in doing experiments. The first of those is realism. That's the idea that objects that are perceived have an existence outside the mind. It's not just all in our head. Something, at least, is outside of us. Rationality is the idea that reasoning is the basis for solving problems, that we can use logic and reasoning to figure out what's going on. Regularity is the idea that things exist in recurring patterns and that those patterns are consistent with universal laws. Discoverability, we can learn solutions to the questions that we face. And causality, that every event has a cause. Those are pretty typical for the, as far as psychologists' assumptions about experience. Now, one thing that I found interesting is that when I look at those assumptions that psychologists have about experience, there's some similarity between them and Mormon beliefs. At least at one level there is. Regarding realism, that's the idea that things exist outside of our mind. We have scriptures such as, there's no such thing as immaterial matter, that all spirit is matter, but it's more fine or more pure. Suggesting there is something real outside of our own perception. Oliver Cowdery's attempt to translate the Book of Mormon, that is consistent with the idea of rationality. You have to figure it out first and then pray and see if it's right. Regularity is a common theme in LDS theology, the idea that even God is subject to laws, universal laws. That seems consistent with it to me. Discoverability, that's the essence of Moroni's promise, that that we can find out the answers to our questions about the Book of Mormon in some cases or other questions. And then causality shows itself in the teachings that blessings result from obedience to laws, that basic idea. Things are caused by other things. So at least at one level, we can see some kinds of similarities. But of course, it's not completely harmonious. There are important differences between psychological and Mormon views of what make experience. One important difference is what you might call the starting point. A psychologist doing an experiment really doesn't have to hope that it comes out one way or the other, just as a physicist or chemist might not really have any kind of personal investment or expectation that theory A is supported over theory B. They might, but they don't need to. That doesn't necessarily seem to be the case with religious matters. Moroni tells us that when we pray to learn about the truth of the Book of Mormon, he says that we need to remember how merciful the Lord has been. That kind of statement assumes that we believe that the Lord is there and that the Lord has been merciful. So a different sort of assumption exists in the Mormon approach to what experience is. Now, in psychology, there's been a line of research regarding what you're probably familiar with as a self-fulfilling prophecy. That's the idea that we need to have that what we expect to happen happens because of the way that we approach it. This kind of phenomenon is illustrated really well in a famous experiment that was called Pygmalion in the Classroom. In this experiment, teachers were led to expect that certain students would excel more than others would at the beginning of the school year. In fact, students had been randomly assigned to either the excelling group or the average group, but and at the beginning of the year, there was no real difference between those two groups. But what happened was the teachers expected the one group to outperform the other, and somehow they interacted with those students in such a way that they actually did. By the end of the year, the group that was expected to perform well did outperform the group that was expected to be average. That's the idea of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now, if we take that idea and apply it to the personal religious experiment, you might say, that Alma describes in 2, there's a bit of a problem. Let me read part of Alma 32. Alma says, after describing how we can't have a perfect understanding of Alma's testimony and understanding, he says, "If you will awake and arouse your faculties, even to an experiment on my words, and exercise a particle of faith, yea, even if you can no more than desire to believe, let this desire work in you, even until you believe in a manner that you can give place for a portion of my words." He seems to be suggesting to me that in order to find the answer that we're seeking, we have to believe just a little bit, maybe, but we have to have some measure of belief in the answer that we're seeking. Sounds kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy to me. Now, from the perspective of the psychologist, this would appear to place an important limit on the personal religious experiment that we're all encouraged to do. The idea behind psychology, whether the psychology I teach in my classroom, that is, not necessarily the one that you're familiar with from Oprah Winfrey or wherever, the idea behind psychology is to establish a theory and be objective in your testing of the theory to see how it all shakes out. If the evidence supports the theory, then great. If not, well, then you need to discard it or modify it or try to get additional data to clarify things. But the psychologist doing that experiment really shouldn't have to have an expectation that things will turn out a particular way. So in some sense, that places limits on the kind of confirmation that we might expect if we're gathering evidence through our experiences. Some evidence maybe ought to weigh a little more heavily than other kinds of evidence. Now, having said that, it's important for me and other psychologists to recognize that what we do isn't all as objective as we really hope it to be. One good example comes from the research on conformity. During the early 1960s especially, there was a real interest in conformity. And a lot of the research done at that time found pretty consistently that women were more likely to conform than men were in a group situation. And that was pretty much the canon, if you will, for several years. But after 10, 15 years, additional research started to accumulate that really pointed out that this wasn't necessarily the case. The early researchers were men, and they designed studies that involved tasks that the men were familiar with. Later researchers were more often women, and in their studies, they used different kinds of tasks. So the women, as they did their research, they found that there either was no difference or that men were more likely to conform. So these really underlying basic hidden assumptions really do color the process. And so people like me, we're left with a dilemma. Probably people like you too, as you get the different experiences and hear different kinds of information. That is, what kind of experience do you really rely on? From my perspective, I probably would give more weight to the scientific kinds of experiences because they at least let us discover some of those biases. If we stop the time clock at 1965 and we see women conform more than men, then our view really is biased. But as time we do additional research in the public venue of science, we can start to discover some of those biases. And I don't see the same kinds of public interaction in religious experiences. We can all go to testimony meeting and confirm our experiences that way, but those venues seem a little bit biased, even though I go to those and I benefit from them too. I have to say that they seem a little bit biased in favor of a particular view. And so that's the starting point, I guess you might say. Now, in terms of the experiences that we have, what I've described is at least a taste of the underlying assumptions, you might say. Now, what I'd like to do is to look at maybe three different areas of experience and see what psychology has to say about these religious kinds of experiences that we might have. One area that's getting increasing attention is the idea that biology might have a role to play in religion and in religious experiences. Now, when I teach intro to psychology, students are pretty regularly dismayed that they thought they were studying psychology and here all of a sudden they have biology. So let me just explain why the psychologist should even care about that. Well, we're biological beings. Even if we have a soul, I tend to think we do, but even if we have a soul, it exists somehow connected with this physical structure. And what we found is that physical thing has an impact on our... here's redundancy. Our physical bodies have an impact on our lives. How's that? We exist within this body, or we're connected somehow to it, and so we have to recognize those kinds of influences. Now, in terms of religious experiences, what we have are two competing kinds of trends. On the one hand, we use our body to gain and facilitate religious experience. In Mormonism, we fast and we pray, and that somehow heightens our sense of spirituality. Hindus practice yoga. Buddhists meditate. We do these different activities in order to improve our spirituality. On the other hand, we have things... We have the belief that our body somehow inhibits our spirituality. We have carnal desires. We do things, physical things, that limit our spiritual growth. So we have this tension between the two. Now, if we try to understand how the body is connected then with our religious experiences, we have several lines of research. I don't have time to talk about all of them, so let me just talk about a couple. One line of research that psychologists have been interested in has to do with heredity and genetics. In general, what's done is by comparing identical twins with fraternal twins who are raised together or who are raised apart, you get those four different combinations of twins and living arrangements, you can start to understand a little bit about how much variability can be accounted for by genetic factors or by environmental factors. So, for example, when we study personality traits, what tends to be found is that about half of the variability in all these twins' personality seems to be accounted for by hereditary factors. The other half seems to be accounted for by the environment or its combination with heredity. Well, that's usually the kind of research that's done. A few years ago, though, some people at the University of Minnesota did a project in which they investigated religious attitudes. They asked these twins, these four different kinds of twins, how much they were interested in becoming a priest or a pastor, how much they read about religion in their spare time, different activities like this concerning religious life, basically religious attitudes. And what they found was essentially the same kinds of results that we find with personality. That the closer a relationship is biologically, the more similar their attitude is about religion. And that seems to outweigh the contribution of the environment. That's an interesting thing to me. It's interesting to think about. Let me come back to that in just a second. A different line of research has to do with the brain. Now, we don't do experiments with the brain, and that's probably a good thing, too. But every now and then, someone has done a research project in which they've been able to try to manipulate the brain and see what happens. A lot of what they've found seems to emphasize the right temporal lobe as a source or a center or an important area in trying to understand things that we might consider to be religious experiences. One researcher basically on occasion has the opportunity to stimulate areas of a person's brain. When he stimulates the right temporal lobe, this area around here, people often report hearing voices, mystical kinds of voices, things almost like a revelation, kind of an auditory revelation. Another researcher has compared the brain waves of people who have different levels of activity in the right temporal lobe. But what he's found is that those who have more spikes in their brainwave activity are more likely to report in their everyday life, they're more likely to report having really intense mystical experiences, intense religious, spiritual kinds of experiences. Now, all of this research is really very preliminary. It's not a huge body of literature by any means. And I'm sure that we'll learn more about these relationships as we learn more about the brain or heredity and all of those factors. But I don't know about you. I'm a curious person now, and I'm not inclined to wait and say, you know, well, I'll just put this question on the back burner until people find out more. It's interesting to think about. What would it mean if, let's say, hereditary factors impact my general attitude toward the church, or maybe why I dislike home teaching? It's an interesting question to wonder about. I'm not saying I dislike it because, you know, chromosome number 18 is a little screwy, but it's interesting to wonder about. I see a few implications. One of the implications has to do with the idea of choice. We tend to think that if it's biological, we didn't choose it. I tend to think that. I don't remember choosing to be bald. Maybe I did, but I don't recall that. These things just happen to our bodies. Now, if we take that question of choice and apply that to religious questions, I think it's an important... We get some important kinds of things to consider. For example, are we supposed to have a certain personality in the church? Well, Calvin Grandal's cartoons would suggest that some people think so, that we promote certain characteristics. Others of us would say maybe not. Well, to the extent that traits like showing concern and showing love might be considered personality, then it seems as though we should try to encourage certain characteristics and discourage others. Now, the possibility of change also comes into play with questions like are certain people closer to God than others? People who are different in terms of basic physical characteristics. Some people read the Book of Mormon and said, yeah, it looks like they are. Here we have white and delightsome folks. These are the ones who are closer to God. Well, a few years ago, that's been changed to pure and delightsome. So maybe some of those kinds of implications or questions are being dealt with on an institutional level. A second kind of example that comes into play deals with individual church members' attitudes towards things like homosexuality. One perspective is the idea that sexual orientation comes from some kind of combination of choice and maybe social factors, that it's not a biological thing. Others would say that it is biologically determined, and because God made people this way, then that way of being should be celebrated and encouraged. And lots of people have feelings somewhere in between those two kinds of extremes. Regardless of the view that we take on that question, I think it seems, well, and let me just mention one other kind of research. In general, the research that's done on homosexuality increasingly seems to be taking a biological stance, suggesting that perhaps physiological or genetic kinds of factors might cause someone to be homosexual. But it's more complicated than even the researchers understand. I read one study just a few months ago in which the researcher found that mice or rats, I'm pretty sure it was rats, might have been mice, that sexual activity caused actual changes in the neurons of the rats. So here we have actions causing physical changes. It's an interesting and, I don't know, mind-blowing kind of thing to think about. Well, those are some of the kinds of questions that come up when you look at how physical factors might influence our psychological experience. Like I said at the beginning, I'm not reading my paper. Had I read my paper, I would have said my view from the intersection of psychology and religion is one that brings lots of questions, probably more questions than answers. Those are some of the things that I have questions about. It's interesting to think about and try to understand. I'm not going to claim that I do understand them all, but it's really fascinating to consider. Now, another area of research has to do with religion and mental health. In my naive growing up down the street, I grew up with basically the idea that Mormons were good. And in fact, I had lots of experiences that confirmed that. On the other hand, as I've grown up and interacted with more Mormons, I found some of them don't seem to be quite so good. And sometimes seem to be a little off-kilter, you might say. When we consider mental health, there are lots of different interrelationships that we have to recognize and deal with. First of all, we have to recognize that there are different ways of trying to understand religiousness. What I want to do is briefly mention one of the more common ways. A lot of research that's been done in psychology regarding religion looks at basically three different kinds of motivations that people have for being religious. One is where religion is a means to some other end. The person who belongs to the church because it's a good way to make sales contacts. That's the extrinsic type. Another approach would be what we call the intrinsic type. That's where religion is an end itself. The person seems compelled to be religious and be involved in religion. A third approach is where religion is a way of dealing with existential questions. That approach is known as religion as a quest. When we consider mental health, there are also lots of different ways of defining what mental health is. One review came up with seven different ways. They included things like mental health is the absence of mental illness. That's like saying what salt is. It's not sugar. Another approach is to say that mental health is where your social behavior is appropriate for the situation. You could imagine if someone does something that we would all consider extremely inappropriate, one of the things that would cross our minds is, well, you know, maybe they're crazy. That's that idea. Mental health, other people have defined as being free from guilt and worry. maybe a sense of personal control and competence and ability, a sense of self-actualization or self-acceptance, open-mindedness and flexibility. Lots of different definitions of mental health exist. Well, when you combine all those mental health definitions with religion definitions to see how religion relates to mental health, you get the kind of picture that looks like this. The person who's religious to get something else, depending on how you define mental health, they're generally found to be less healthy than the person who is not. Religion as a means to some other end is less healthy, you might say. Religion as an end itself tends to be found as being more healthy. The person who goes to church for personal reasons instead of social ones is more healthy, depending on the details. They're more likely to, for example, to have a sense of personal competence and control. The person who approaches religion as a sort of quest for existential questions is more likely to be healthy if you define mental health as a sense of open-mindedness and flexibility and self-acceptance. In other ways, there seems to be no relationship between that approach, the quest approach, and mental health. Well, all of that research has tended to be done on Christians in general. Some studies involve Jews, but mostly Christians in general. So we might wonder, how do Mormons compare with the rest of Christianity? In recent years, have been a couple of useful sources to begin to deal with these kinds of questions. Lester Bush, a chapter in his book on religion and health, Mormonism and health. I messed up the title there, but if you're really curious, ask me afterwards. It's in my notes back here. He looks at mental health in Mormonism in the broad cultural context. And a lot of what he finds seems to be consistent to me with what David Knowlton said in a recent, maybe this most recent, dialogue, where Mormonism is suspicious of secular, psychological, psychiatric kinds of approaches to things. And there's a relationship there, but it's an uncomfortable one. Another useful kind of source for trying to understand the religion and Mormonism and mental health question was published a few years ago by Alan Bergen and some of his colleagues. And that study, or that chapter, it relied a lot on unpublished research, master's theses, doctoral dissertations. And it's interesting because it finds essentially the same kinds of relationships that the work does with broader Christianity. Among Mormons, the Mormons who use Mormonism to gain something else seem to be, on the whole, less mentally well than Mormonisms who use religion, who are religious for its own sake. Those folks seem to be more mentally well off. Less, or perhaps maybe none, research has been done regarding the quest orientation in mental health. It's a relatively new approach, and there's just not much, perhaps any, research on that. Now, I mentioned a moment ago my naive growing up down the street. I have to confess just a little bit that it suffered a bit of a blow when I realized that Mormons weren't better off than everybody else. Somehow I thought in my rosy world that the peak of the Wasatch was the peak of the world. I didn't realize there are other peaks in the world. And I don't, maybe this is unique, maybe no one else has experienced this, but it was something of a bop on the head to wake me up. And that happened all about the same time I began to be interested in psychology. Well, if we interpret these kinds of research results in that sort of framework, then I think it's really pretty troubling, because what it says is that religion doesn't seem to have any effect on mental health, at least that Mormons aren't such a peculiar people after all. On the other hand, I'm not so sure that we should expect Mormons necessarily to be free from mental illness. I don't know that that makes any sense. The rain seems to fall here as well as in Colorado or those other kinds of pagan places. That's a joke. Y'all don't know my sense of humor, but. So I think that we need to be cautious when we interpret research results, and try not to be as naive as I was, and hopefully I'm not as naive as I was myself. But I think it's interesting to consider that first of all, there are relatively few studies that compare Mormons with non-Mormons. When you do those sorts of comparisons, you don't find Mormons being particularly different from non-Mormons. Now, the third general area I'd like to mention has to do with religion and helping. One of my favorite Bible stories is the parable of the Good Samaritan. And I like how it conveys that we should try to interact with people in a good way, try to do good things for others. It illustrates one of the kind of puzzles, though, that seems to come up in different ward council meetings and that sort of thing. And that is that, do we want people to do the right thing for the right reason, or do we just want them to do the right thing, and then maybe they'll figure out the right reason? I don't know how many times I've heard that basic question dealt with. One researcher, Dan Batson, has really been fascinated by that question. He got a doctorate in theology and then a doctorate in psychology. And he was a little suspicious that just maybe the Good Samaritan, wasn't as altruistic as we might think. People knew that he did all these good acts. And maybe his good works might have been a means to some other end. Now, I don't know that you necessarily need to agree with that, but that's what stimulated his line of research in religion and helping. And it's pretty interesting for some of the implications. There are basically two threads that seem to be important. One thread of studies is they typically compare religious people with non-religious people and ask how often they help, how concerned they are about other folks, those kinds of things. And very consistently what those studies find is that people who are religious are more concerned about others, and they say that they help other people more often than the non-religious people do. But when you look at those studies and separate out the ones that actually measure helping, behavioral manifestations of that concern, what you find is that there's no difference between the two groups. The religious people think that they're more charitable, more giving, but in terms of what they actually do, there appears to be no difference. He does mention one study in which there is a difference, but that study's authors, in describing the results, they say it looks like people are more helpful, but because of all these different circumstances, we have to conclude that they're doing it basically to look good and not because they're genuinely more concerned. So that's an interesting line of research. Apparently, those of us who are religious think about being helpful, but when it comes actually down to it, we may not actually be more helpful than those who are not religious. Now, that's one thread of studies. The other thread of studies is done mainly by Batson and a few other folks, but mainly by Batson himself. And in those studies, what he does is he gives people an opportunity to help. He presents them with a situation basically like the Good Samaritan, and that was the first study that he did. He had someone basically lying in a doorway, kind of moaning, and that person moaning in the doorway was a helper for one of Batson's confederates, he calls them. He's in on the study. And in the research, people are sent on a route from one building to another that requires them to pass by this person. And what happened was when the person walking in the study, walking by, sees the person moaning in the doorway, apparently needing help, the first thing that he was interested in was whether or not the person even stopped to offer some help. If the person did stop to offer help, the person in the doorway declined the help. He said, no, I'm fine. I just took my medicine. I'll be fine in just a minute. Now, Batson's thinking is, his question of interest is, what happens if we're presented with an opportunity to help, and we offer to help, and the person that we offer to help says, no thanks, I'm fine. Batson's idea is that if that happens, and we help anyway, then probably our source of concern is ourselves and our own concern rather than the person who's being helped. Now, really oversimplified, but that's the main idea. When you look at those kinds of studies and you compare the people who are walking by in terms of their religiousness, their intrinsicness or extrinsicness or quest orientation toward religion, what you find is the people who are religious as a means to some other end, they're less likely to help. The people who are religious for an end itself, they're more likely to help even if the person says, no thanks, I'm fine. The people whose orientation toward religion is as a quest are more likely to offer the help, but if the person says, no thanks, then they're more likely just to say, okay, you're sure you're all right? They say, fine, okay, we'll move on. Batson interprets those studies to suggest that, at least in some cases, religiousness may demarcate or may signify a group of people who are actually more helpful than others. I've really condensed it and left out some details, but that's the basic kind of study and an outcome that he finds. Now, there's been genuinely little research done with Mormonism and helping. There was one study done about 30 years ago, but that was one of those that just asked people if they thought they were more helpful. And, of course, Mormons were among those who thought they were more helpful. But they didn't actually, in that study, measure helping. So here's an area where we have lots of possible questions to ask or to seek answers for. Now, for individual Mormons like me and you, I think some of the implications that we might get from this line of research are interesting. What does it mean if I help somebody for the wrong reason? Or if I actually do my home teaching, but only because I feel guilty? What's the implication of that? We might ask ourselves if it matters if we do the right thing for the wrong reason. As I read Christ's words, Christ in the scripture says, as we think in our hearts, so are we. Well, and he didn't have very kind things to say about hypocrites. It would suggest to me that it really does matter what our motivation is. If we're going to help, we ought to help for a good reason and not just because we feel some other motivation. I think it poses similar questions for us as an institutional church. We do wonder or at least I wonder from time to time about the institution's motivation for doing some of the things it does. We read, by their fruits you shall know them. It has had headlines in newspapers and on television of occasions where it's helped in the rebuilding of a black church that was burned by racists. Factors or mental health and helping social behavior, we find some ways that religion seems to promote certain experiences and other ways where it tries not to promote them. And we get interesting relationships when we look at how religion is related to those different areas of life, that bring up lots of interesting questions. So now that we have those different kinds of questions, what do we do? This is something I've asked myself quite often. If I know this body of knowledge and I know that body of knowledge, do those two bodies meet, or do they just kind of bump against each other and not really intersect? Well, for what it's worth, I think there are a few important things to keep in mind. The first is the difference between explaining something and explaining it away. Just because we can explain something doesn't mean that we've explained away all the details and beauty of it. In that regard, there are a couple of important points. One is that we need to remember the importance of finding confirming sources. It's basic to Mormonism. We go out two by two. We have two books. We do all, well, more than two, but we started out with two anyway. We seek confirmation of our experiences from multiple sources. That's something that's in common not only with Mormonism, but also with psychology and other sciences. We don't just do one experiment and say, oh, we've got it figured out. We do one experiment, then someone else, or maybe ourselves, tries to replicate it, reproduce it, and see if we get the same kinds of things. If we do, then great. If not, then we have to step back and figure out why that is. Maybe our theory's messed up. Maybe the data are sometime flawed. We need to understand things from many different sources. That's one thing that they have in common. A second point that I find personally useful is the idea of tentativeness. Now, my favorite article of faith is the one where I say that, but you know, if you paid me $100 right now, I couldn't quote it to you. But it's the idea that's really important to me, and that is the idea that even in this fullness of dispensation of times, we still say there are things that we don't know yet. We have to be open to new revelation, new ideas. That suggests that the knowledge we have is tentative. Now, I and my person sitting next to me in Elders' Quorum might disagree about just how tentative that is, but there's some element of tentativeness. That's true in science also. We don't simply say we've got it figured out. So there's something that the two have in common that I find useful. A third point that I find useful is that people differ enormously in terms of how much they find, how much they need certainty, how much they can tolerate ambiguity, how much they're open to new ideas and new experiences. There are very wide-ranging differences among us in those kinds of traits. And they suggest to me that we really need to be open-minded to others' orientation toward that kind of thing in general. I might be really open-minded to new ideas. Someone else may not be. And we need to understand that basic kind of difference. That's true. That's an important point that I, as a Mormon, need to keep in mind as I'm thinking uncharitable things about the person sitting next to me in Elders' Quorum, because they seem to be so closed-minded. That's something I find important to do, is to remind myself of that. Another important point is that I think we need to understand is the idea that simply becoming more familiar with something doesn't mean we appreciate it less. When I go to a concert, I was a music major before I became a psychology student, and I essentially finished the music education degree. So I learned a little bit about musical form and structure, a little bit about acoustics, not enough, but some. And it's really enriched my enjoyment of concerts, of music. I don't see that the same thing can't be true in terms of understanding religion and people's experiences in religion. By understanding them, that can enrich us. Some scientists may learn more and come away with the conclusion that, you know, it's all just a matter of learning or something else. I'm not one of those. It seems that the more I learn, the more rich the experience is. Now, part of that richness is because sometimes those, I don't know why I'm thinking about food right now, but maybe it's because I've never eaten in this restaurant before, but sometimes there are these taste sensations that are just wonderful that I would never have thought to put together. To get a sweet thing and a sour thing and a spicy thing and put them in the same dish, that makes the food experience really a rich experience. Those conflicting flavors add to the overall experience. The same thing is true, I think, or can be true when we try to understand individual religious experience and the different kinds of explanations that we might get. They can enrich our understanding. So from my view at this intersection of Mormonism and psychology, I guess I would conclude by saying at this point that by combining the two, we really can have a better appreciation of the whole. We can have a sense of what we understand and what we don't, and what might some of the implications of our understanding be. And so, since there is no discussant for this, I suppose if you have questions or comments, that's what we ought to do next. Yes. Let me hand this to you so they can hear on the tape.
I just wondered if you have found likes and dislikes in gene structure, like blue eyes and brown eyes. I run into things that I have thought, I just dreamed up myself and thought this was going to be a great idea that I could do this in a Relief Society class, and found out that both my grandmother and my great-grandmother did the same things. And I'm wondering if this really couldn't be something that falls upon us through our gene structure. Have you run onto anything like that?
Well, from what I understand, there's a big project called the Human Genome Project, and what they're basically trying to do is map that kind of thing. It's not far enough along to say that here on this section of a gene is a person's likes and dislikes. But it's conceivable that that might happen. They're learning a great deal about various kinds of diseases and what sorts of hereditary component there might be to those. And that's where most of their research is focusing on right now. It's a good question. Oh, gosh. I almost felt like Donahue.
Are there any particular areas of mental health that Mormons seem to do particularly better or worse than the average?
Are there any areas of mental health where we do better or worse? Well, probably the one that got the most attention dealt with depression, but the early studies that suggested Mormons are more depressed than non-Mormons, most of the researchers now think that those had flaws. And if you do more rigorous research, they don't seem to find the difference that appeared there earlier on. So in general, to my knowledge, there are not. We're not so peculiar. Okay, am I aware of research about schizophrenia and the onset occurring right before remission or during? Well, the research that I am aware of tends to find, first of all, an important genetic or hereditary or biological kind of component, and it seems to happen about that age. I don't know of any research that would suggest that there's something about the mission experience that causes it. Right, it seems to be more a matter of age. Yeah, go ahead. I'll repeat it for the mic. Sure. The question was, are the church's rituals and manuals and standardized products conducive to religious experience? And then the second one is how appropriate they might be for a worldwide church. And from my perspective, well, Offhand, I'd basically say no on both counts. They seem to exist. Well, when you look at what a religious experience is, there's really a wide range. Some people, a religious experience is very, very contemplative and quiet. Others is much more. They don't have a religious experience unless they're very boisterous. But in terms of what it seems to do, I'd say that the general, say, sacrament meeting isn't very effective in promoting a religious experience. And especially when it comes to how that might apply to someone in Africa or another culture. Because a lot of how we define what a religious experience is depends on the cultural context. That'd be my quick answer, but there's a longer one.
Excuse me. We must dismiss it with a great deal of thanks to Dr. Nielsen. And those of you who have questions and would like to visit with him, please feel free to stay and discuss your questions. Thank you.
Thanks.